the editor behind a chic new food and travel magazine, a tower of new subscription tips, and a world record holder with an insatiable appetite for print. The raw copy is coming in for edition 31 of The Stack. My name's Tom Edwards, filling in today for Tyler Brulé. Over the next 60 minutes, we'll meet Dana Abdullah, the editor of Kalimat, a magazine with a fresh take on Middle Eastern culture. Plus, we get some reading tips from James Hyman, a music consultant who holds the Guinness World Record for having the world's largest magazine collection.
Well, I bought in a vintage NME because I love, at the moment, being nostalgic about 80s NMEs. I bought in Little White Lies. It's a movie magazine that restores my faith in cinema. I bought in The New Yorker because I love long-form writing.
All that and a few more reading tips coming up today on edition 31 of The Stack. Hello from Midori House in London, where Studio One is once again full of creatives and editors who are champions of the printed page. It's been a somewhat unpredictable month for the industry. The famous entertainment trade magazine Daily Variety has announced it will now become a weekly. Disconcerting news for a title that's been going for 80 years. But on the other side of the pond, innovative and independent publishers are not just making their mark, but growing. Londoner Will Hudson, the man behind It's Nice That, has just launched a new mag, appropriately called The Printed Page. And you needn't look much further than today's guest magazine reviewers to know that, despite what the consultants might say, print is far from dead. Let's meet our guests now. Our first guest is the editor of food and travel magazine Serial. Rosa Park started the magazine in Bristol last year. Since then, it's gained a following with print connoisseurs all around the world. Rosa's CV also includes stints at Tea, the New York Times style supplement, and Crumbs magazine. Rosa, welcome to The Stack. Thanks very much for joining me today. Let me just start by asking you a bit about Serial. Take us back to the days before it had begun. Where did the idea really come from, and what were your sort of objectives at that stage?
Okay, I guess Serial began right after I had graduated from school. I moved to England to get a master's in English Lit, and afterwards I was looking for jobs, trying to see what I wanted to do, and I knew that I wanted to write for a magazine. So whilst doing job research, I kind of thought to myself, it would be really cool to have my own. And it obviously took a little bit more time till I actually did it. But as you said, I worked at a local food magazine called Crumbs for a year, and I actually helped launch it. And I think going through that process made me realize, you know what, I can actually do this myself. And I always wanted to have a food and travel magazine that would be literally quite like a book. So we are divided into chapters. We have a bibliography with endnotes. And I just kind of wanted a publication that would look at these two topics, but from a very ideas and historical point of view. That's what we do. When we talk about food, it's not really about restaurants or recipes. It's more about, let's look at the history of pepper and why salt is good or bad for you, things like that.
And tell me a little bit about, in terms of the sort of design, the design aspect of the magazine. It's fairly minimalistic. Is that fair to say? What is the kind of aesthetics that you've tried to kind of introduce with the magazine?
I think clean and minimal are probably the two words that I would use to describe what we look like. People have said that we're quite Scandinavian, which I'll take as a compliment. I think for us, we just really wanted the words and photos themselves to shine. That's what the spotlight is on. And I don't like clutter as much for readability. So, you know, the design is a reflection of that.
And in terms of how you sort of impact your own attitudes and your personality on the magazine, if a reader picks up Serial, how much are they hearing and seeing Rosa, and how much are they seeing the product of your labours? How do you sort of bring that sort of quality of yourself onto the page? Is it a really personal experience, do you think?
I think it is an incredibly personal experience, because everything that's in the magazine, I have traveled to that place, I have eaten there, I have stayed there, I have experienced it, and I kind of like that creative control where I pick every single thing that goes into the magazine, and it is an extension of the things that interest me and things that I like.
Now, our second guest joining me today could be in contention for being the biggest magazine fan we've ever had on the stack. James Hyman holds the Guinness World Record for owning the largest magazine collection. Around 50,000?
Well, it was when I had that record. I could comfortably break the record now. Oh. It's up to about 60,000.
60,000.
Bear in mind, it's constantly growing.
This is exciting stuff. And yep. He's currently in the process of turning this library into an archive as a day job. James is also a respected music consultant and DJ. James, welcome indeed.
Thank
to
you for having me.
The stack. So tell me, you mentioned this collection there, burgeoning, growing all the time. What does it actually look like, this collection?
It's a fantastic. Well, at the moment, it looks like the end scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where that guy's wheeling those whatever crates of stuff to be covered in dust. That's what it looks like right now. When it's out, it looks beautiful. It's really mesmerizing. Everyone, while it was being archived, and I must give credit to Tori Turk, who, you know, did the bulk of that work for me, when it was being archived, it was gorgeous. You know, people who'd come down and see it were just absolutely mesmerized by it. It looks like something beautiful.
It sounds beautiful. That many magazines in one place.
You get
beautiful.
Lost in it. You really get lost in it.
And tell me about the process then of archiving something like that. Where do you start? Had you always had a bit of a system or?
No, it's a very good question. What we did was I had in the back of my mind for years and years and years, I had these in those crates and my wife kept nagging me, sort it out, deal with it and, you know, get it out. So the time came and things fell into place. I got some space in Islington, and the randomness of it was each crate was not sort of like, I hadn't, you can imagine when you're accumulating all these magazines, you can't say, you know, I didn't have all the Faces and all the Playboys and all the enemies. It was, I would be buying one issue of this, one issue of that. So when they came out, plus I had duplicates, which was a nasty problem. So they had to be sorted out. We didn't actually have enough space really to sort them all out. So systematically, we worked through it, you know, alphabetically and chronologically, and we got there in about a year, and the whole thing was archived from alphabeticized and in date order. So you're going from whatever, .net magazine right through to, I can't remember, Zuropa magazine or something. 2,500 different titles as well.
The process almost as interesting as the collection itself.
Thank you.
We'll talk a little bit more about the archive and the purpose of it later. I just wondered, you mentioned there the actual accumulation of all this print. How did that happen? You bought magazines wherever you went, or word got around and people said, we must send James a few copies?
Thank you. This is like therapy. Bring this out because I need it. What I did was that, I mean, I think it started as a kid, comics. I loved a lot of comics like, I can't remember, you know, Wizard and Chips, Cheeky Monster Fun, Mad, Cracked. Then I sort of evolved into Smash Hits and a few stuff. And I treasured them, so I wouldn't throw them away. I think a tipping point came when I was at MTV. I was a script writer for MTV in the late 80s to the early 90s, and I stayed at MTV to 2000 producing shows. But one of my first jobs, I was script writing for the presenters. Now, I was passionate, and I always compared this to being like a lawyer. If you do your job, do it right, properly. Don't just say, hey, this is a cool video. No, get some information. And this was all pre-internet, so your best source was magazines. So that gave me a big bug. It was like, right, I'm going to buy all these magazines. And they were very kind. You know, I had an allowance to go and buy some magazines. And then I started getting sent them from people because I just blagged my way onto these lists because it was costing me an absolute fortune. You know, I was buying up back collections again because I remember, I think it was a one weekend, maybe they had a Prince weekend. So I thought, right, I need to know everything about Prince. So I'm going to buy all the issues of Q because Q would have had a lot of Prince in there and Rolling Stone. So that was a lot of the process in accumulating stuff. It would go into crates. It would destroy people's houses due to weight. My parents were upset. My best friend was upset. But it was, they would go off into this storage. And, you know, it's been unearthed 2011. So that's a little potted history of how they were accumulating. Yeah, going to Tower Records every Friday night, coming home with bags, going to Borders and constantly buying. I mean, I'd go to town. They would think, you know, I worked there because I was just like, just magazines all over the place. So
It's a pretty extraordinary story, James. I wonder, Rosa, does that strike a chord with you? Do you remember your sort of early love affairs with particular magazines? Was it the same, or was it something that came to you slightly more gradually, perhaps?
I have been obsessed with magazines, and I have collected them since I was 8 or 9, which is, I think, quite young to begin this love affair with magazines. And I was actually just telling James when I met him that I thought I had a pretty sizable magazine collection. And then I saw how many he had and put my collection to shame. But yeah, I think those that love magazines usually start it from an early age. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the quantity. It really could be the quality. You could say, look, some person just wants 4 titles. You know, he likes his yachting weekly, and he's going to stick with that. So I've just gone a bit crazy on, you know, I've had the collector gene and bug that's made it very Herculean, is a word I keep using.
And tell me, James, what's the hierarchy then of these magazines? Do you sometimes go into your archive, take out a few favourites, take them home, maybe keep them in your house? Or are there, I mean, I don't want to give away your trade secrets, but are there particular favourites you think this one needs to be back at home?
A lovely, good question again. I mean, what I'm doing is I'm living off a lot of the duplicates because it's very hard to access the archive at the moment whilst it's in storage. If I had it in this beautiful museum, which is, as we can talk a bit of the plan, then yeah, I would dip in and out. I've got a few spread here. You know, recently, for example, I've been going through some 80s NMEs because, again, this is all pre-internet. So I love the fact that...
What have you got there? Is this a particular favourite? Or
this was just one I randomly picked up, and it talks a lot about when house music was exploding in, you know, the 1986 and 87. So I love going back and reading maybe a good 3-page article about something that was so in-depth, because you've got to imagine, I keep thinking this, there's AI after internet and BI before internet, you know, and... The magazine had so much more, I think, sincere. I mean, that's not fair because, you know, Meeting Rose or something. Magazines are still sincere. People put a lot of time and effort. But then they were really glowing because everyone now has got their blogs, their Twitter feeds there. They can write anything. They can write what they want. But, you know, you really had to put that effort into that magazine, and because you knew that the audience was going to, you know, receive it properly. So, yeah, I'll pick up things. I'll go through a New Yorker, Vanity Fair. Long form stuff is what I really enjoy reading.
Now, Rose, that's quite interesting, isn't it? Looking at, and this is again something I'm sure we'll touch upon later as well, the rise and rise of digital, the threat to print. Is it all this hackneyed thing? Oh, print is dead. And I think we're probably all in agreement that's not the case.
Go to Wardour News. I said it to Rosa. You go inside Wardour News, and you guys, I mean, print, definitely not.
It's thriving, no. If anything. But I wondered, in terms of the area that you're in with your magazine, there's a few other publications doing some similar sorts of things.
Yes.
Do you take a great deal of comfort from that this is really something that's in very robust health? Of course, digital gives a lot more people a lot more access, but as James was suggesting, really, to get the real quality stuff, people want the print, don't they?
Yeah, I think it's reassuring to see so many other wonderful, independent, like-minded magazines like Serial. And there's definitely been an explosion kind of in the last 2 or 3 years that I've noticed, especially in the realm of food and travel. And I think digital is so important, but so is print, and they should really coexist and complement each other. And I don't think one should necessarily overtake the other, which is what a lot of people suggest with online.
I agree. I mean, there was a lovely campaign that the major magazines in America ran in 2010, and it was, will the internet kill magazines? Did instant coffee kill coffee? You know, TV didn't kill movies, video didn't kill radio. And it was true. You know, internet magazines do what the internet doesn't. There's a whole different relationship with a magazine than there is, I think, with digital.
And just looking at this area, we're talking about Serial and some of these other titles, that's sort of food and food and lifestyle. It's an interesting mix. I wondered whether you both thought, is there a sense that is a growth area? It's booming. It's going to continue to grow. Are there more titles that could come out? Because there do seem to be a few more. We look at the likes of Kinfolk, for example, these kinds of titles. There seems to be something of a resurgence in that particular area. James, are you familiar with some of these? Do you think it's an area that can continue to grow and sustain more new titles?
Absolutely, but I see it in a lot of these genres. You know, I mean, I call it fashion porn. The top shelf now has become those glossy fashion ones. They are thriving. Music, I always believe it's like in music itself. People say hip hop died or house died. No, in those magazines, they come and they flourish and they can all survive. Definitely.
And Rosa, what's the sort of environment like then with these other titles? Do you sort of have a look through and think, oh, that's not a bad idea? Or do you have a look through and think, wow, this is nowhere near as good as we've done? Is it sort of friendly rivalry, a bit of borrowing, or just a sort of mutually shared inspiration?
I think as a relative newcomer to the scene, I'm actually in awe of a lot of the titles that, you know, kind of laid the groundwork for magazines like us. And I mean, an example of a magazine that I really love is Boat, the travel title. I think they're fantastic at what they do. And I think... Sure, friendly rivalry, why not? But at the end of the day, I'm just kind of grateful that they're doing their thing, and we can be a part of that and get our voice out there.
That's very diplomatic of you.
It is fascinating. Can I say, just meeting Rosa and her before we came on air, to explaining what she's doing and how well it's doing. It's that's amazing. That really is encouraging, you know, and seeing this stuff and how well produced these things are. You know, that says more, I think, than the digital, where you just quickly just thrash something out, bang, it's done. You know, there's passion and love goes into that stuff.
That's a nice optimistic note. Plenty more to come this hour from James and Rosa. We'll be right back after this to meet the editor of Kalimat, a title that takes a fresh look at Middle Eastern current affairs and culture. The Arab world can be difficult to write about. The endless news cycle that stems from the region has cemented a list of stereotypes that can at times be rather hard to escape. That's why Kalimat magazine is so refreshing. Now in its seventh issue, the title challenges preconceptions about Arab culture with reports on design, politics, fashion, and literature. Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brûlé spoke with Kalimat's editor Dana Abdullah about the magazine's beginnings.
Kalimat started when I was in Nablus in Palestine, and I was teaching third-year engineering students. They had asked me to teach them English as a second language, and I have no idea how to teach English. So I realized that a lot of them didn't know how to converse. They just knew how to kind of regurgitate the information that was in their book. But I also noticed that a lot of them had great stories to tell, but they didn't have an outlet for them because they couldn't write in English. Most of the magazines that were international were obviously written in English. And then you had a lot of others that were writing about Palestine, as the example, because that's where I was. But the experience of myself and a foreigner in Palestine is very different from someone who's Palestinian, because my passport is Canadian. I can move around as much as I want. So I thought that it would be a good idea to, you know, provide an open outlet for people who English isn't necessarily their first language, and help them through the editing process to sort of get them to a level where they could publish. So that's why the articles are sort of, some of them are, you know, very well written by people that are have written for magazines before. And then you have some that have really, really great stories, but are sort of works in progress. Mm. So that's what I was trying to, that's basically the idea that I had.
Mm. And how long was the process from, as you were saying at the start, recognizing there was, you know, potentially, you know, a gap to launch this to really deciding you were going to raise some money to do this and you were going to talk to printers and make the whole thing happen?
I've actually been wanting to do something for quite a long time because I grew up with a activist family. Politics were always very big when I grew up. But I also had a fine art background, and so that was important for me to sort of blend in both of these interests that I had. And that was just when I went there, kind of the idea just came to me. It was sort of trying to look for it. And then in terms of funding, when I didn't really find the funding first, I sort of self-funded it after I did my master's. So when I was paying off my master's, I thought, hey, why not pay off a print issue? So I sold my condo at King and Bathurst, and there we go.
Amazing. But now you're running this out of London. London would, let's say, be your editorial base. As much as when you look at the master of the magazine is registered as a nonprofit in Canada. But this is where, all of the ideas are being generated from, or the intake happens, printed here and then distributed. So printing in the UK, and then where are you targeting this? Because obviously, you know, we know the scale of the diaspora, but when you sort of put this to bed and you think about this landing on coffee tables or on newsstands, do you think it has a spiritual home?
Ooh, that's a really tough question. Not really. No, I mean, it's right now it's distributed absolutely everywhere because not absolutely everywhere, but in very key locations because I want it to sort of be this kind of transit magazine where you could take it wherever it is. It is sort of has relevance. Our largest distribution is in London, obviously. This is a big market for us, and then followed by America, bigger cities such as New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, and then Canada with Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver, Ottawa, obviously, because that's where I grew up.
Where did you go to high school in Ottawa?
I went to De La Salle High School.
Oh, you went to De La Salle. I went to Nepean.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, but we can talk about that when we're off air. Anyway.
Then, surprisingly, one of the bigger markets for us has been Germany. And I was very impressed by that, actually. I wasn't really thinking that cities with large Arab diaspora populations would be more successful because a lot of our readers are non-Arabs, and that's really good for me. That's what I want. I want a mix of both, but I really actually appreciate when it's non-Arabs. So Germany has been key for us, and so has Italy, which has been quite surprising as well.
You're $12.95. You're probably going to be $15 US, something in that area. That is a high cover price. And someone say that almost moves you into territory where people are really sort of contributing, helping truly finance it at that rate. Do you also then think about your reader in a different way, potentially?
Well, I think of, my subscribers and, pretty much my readers that I actually know as contributors to the magazine as well. Like, I feel like they take part in the production of it because they are, in a way, financing it by supporting us, by buying it off the newsstands or off our own online shop or subscribing to it. So I think that's important, especially in this day and age where, you have to keep them entertained also online in between issues. That's another important thing. And you also want to make them feel like they're part of your process as well. I think that's what they demand, really. So it is a little bit extra work.
How many issues are you in now?
We're going to be going to issue 8.
Issue 8. So how much are you listening to the room versus just saying, no, my job is an editor. Yes, I will listen to people, but I'm also just, going to go forth and publish something that I believe in. And, and even if people say otherwise.
I definitely try to keep a balance with that. I mean, the one example, whenever somebody asks me that I use is the design. So there's people that'll say, why don't you use a larger typeface? Well, I don't want to.
That always comes up, though. You can make it as big as you want. Someone's always going to have bad eyesight. Always.
Oh, it's not even bad eyesight. They just think it would look better. Or just these kind of comments like, why don't you keep it glossy? But I don't like glossy.
Right.
I personally like matte. And I think that, we like what we're accustomed to. But I don't like glossy. So, I'm designing this thing. I'm editing this thing. This is my baby, so I can put whatever design elements I want in terms of content. Sure, maybe this will get me in trouble with some authorities. Like with issue 5, we were banned in Kuwait and Saudi because the cover was too controversial, and I refused to change it because I thought this reflected the content of the magazine, and I thought it was very important to keep it that way. It's an open outlet. And then, of course, you'll have people that'll say, maybe you should tone it down a bit, but that's when I sort of take a step back and kind of see what I want to do. Like, at the end of the day, it is my project, quote unquote. So it is, and of course the contributors, they play a large role in it, but I kind of have to make some calls that I think are very personal.
That was Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, speaking with Dana Abdullah, editor of Kalamat magazine. You're with The Stack. We'll be back with more Print Chat right after this. You're listening to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Now it's time to delve into our stacks of magazines. James, let's start with you. Talk about some of the things that you've brought in today. I know you've delved into your... It's an unequaled archive. We've established
Thank
that
you.
Already. What are some of the highlights that you've brought along today?
I would like to just say as a little disclaimer before, having read Light and Collected so many, different magazines do resonate in your lifetime. Obviously, I'm sure we can all appreciate that. Smash Hits, whatever, as I say, growing up as a teenager, The Face. But, I will go back. But this was one that definitely got me... exciting time in my life, mid-teens, finishing school, I was learning to DJ, and this magazine came out called Jocks. So it says here, the UK's top-selling DJ magazine. Now, again, you didn't have the internet. This was your source. This was a Bible. It was a lifeline. I was finishing school. Hip-hop, house, all this exciting music was coming out. And there was one guy who wrote in this magazine. He was like a Henry VIII character called James Hamilton. And he was real pompous, loved his food, by the way. So he would have loved Rosemary. He was a real foodie and music. And I just kind of culled a couple of... he wrote onomatopoeically in sound. So you read the reviews of his tunes. You're like, whoa, I've got to go and buy these. You know, there was no SoundCloud, iTunes. You're like, you took this guy's words as gospel. Just to give you a couple of reviews of records that I'm sure you'd know. So Michael Jackson, Bad. This is how he reviewed it. Urgently jittering, 114 BPM smacker with a false fade three quarters through. Madonna, Like a Prayer. Much publicised Pepsi plugging, rather aberrish, chorally supported jiggly surger in Shep Pettibone's bright but trickily stop-starting extended remix, while Bill Petrell's more interesting, sombre and really quite funky 112 and three-quarter BPM club version is easier to use.
It's amazing.
Do you
it's
know
like,
what I mean?
It's like verse, isn't
it's
it?
It's verse, absolutely. So I'm like, that, there we go. I could ramble on.
Jocks. Just tell us about Jocks. Tell our listeners, paint the picture of Jocks there. It's obviously Michael Jackson and his.
So we got, yeah, we
what
got.
Is that mid-80s heyday? Is
absolutely.
It?
We got September 87, yeah, in the real heyday, the Bad Tour. So September 87, issue 11, it cost £1.25.
Cheap at the price.
And there you go. That was the issue that I'm holding in my hand. Backtracking Jacko.
Fantastic. And I see you've got what are some of the others that you've got?
Kind of did
it
a little chronologically. So then I wanted to give a mention to The Face, the Electra cover from May 84. Beautiful yellow Neville Brody. He was the art designer for The Face and Arena. And that actually was another tipping point. That gave me the bug. I was hanging out with two very close friends, Sam Hauser and Terry Donovan, given the mention. They went on to do Rockstar Games and the Grand Theft Autos. And they were like, look in that shop window. And I saw this mag. I'm like, oh, you know, this is history. I don't remember this. Went in the basement. There was all these mags. So that was another pivotal one. Do you want to do another, or is it Rosa's turn?
Let's get Rosa in on the action. Can't let James talk.
So I'm being greedy.
What are some of the ones that... this looks a far more restrained title that you've got, Rosa.
So I've brought in a couple of my favourites. Let's start with Guestbook. And it's a magazine created by the people from One Fine Stay. Do you know... Does everybody know what that is? One Fine Stay is like a posh Airbnb where you stay in people's homes and they're absolutely beautiful. And this is the first issue that they've launched. And I just love the look of it, the size of it, the feel of it. The Guestbook logo is embossed. And I kind of approach it as an interiors magazine in the sense that it's primarily about the beautiful homes that One Fine Stay has, and you get to look at it. But I think the best part about Guestbook is that you can look at it and then you can stay there if you want to.
Nice stuff. Let me have a little look at the Guestbook.
Very good.
Check out this paper. Oh, you see, it's nice stock. Very nice stock. What first sort of appealed to you, apart from the concept then, Rosa, when you see you know, a title like this sort of on the newsstand or it's sent to you, is it the tactile quality of the cover? What's the first thing that jumps out? The feel, the look? Is it until you crack the spine? When's the moment when you think, yes, this makes sense to me?
I love the illustration on the cover of that first one because there's something really kind of charming and eccentric and warm and accessible. You know, you're like, oh, okay, that's quite cool. I want to pick that up. And then you feel the embossed logo and you're kind of hooked. I mean, I love, the tactile feel plays a big role.
And tell me, so how do you come across these new titles? Is it something where they're constantly sent to you? Do people recommend them? Are you always on the hunt in these particular shops that you have where you think, this is the place to go for the best new stuff?
Yeah, it's kind of a mixture. I have the shops that I always go to for new titles. I'm always on the internet looking for new magazines, and friends know how much I love mags, so they always, you know, recommend different ones. This was recommended to me by my best friend, so yeah.
And just to go back, in terms of your sort of working experience, when you're looking at your magazines now, producing your own, looking at other titles on the newsstand, what do you think are the big lessons that you learned from the places you've actually worked? So, for example, on the New York Times Style magazine, was there any sort of particular, sensitivities you developed or directions that people there perhaps, you know, revealed to you that you'd never considered before? Anything that really sort of helped shape your attitude towards the whole industry?
So things that I've learned from my previous jobs. That is an interesting question.
Oh, it's a very short list.
I guess sometimes you're influenced by the places that you work at without even realizing it. It's just you're there, you're in that cultural environment. And I think maybe perhaps aesthetically I've been influenced by where I've worked before. If we're talking about tea, I would say that they lean towards the minimal side of things. And there's a certain stylishness about tea that's not pretentious. That I liked. I mean, they talk about very high-end designers and interiors and travel and books, but at the same time, there's kind of like this informative quality where it's more about the learning and discovering, and I think that's probably translated into how I approach Serial and what we do.
James, I wonder, in terms of your sort of engagement then with magazines and the world of print, is it something where you thought, I just need to own as much as I can because it's such a compelling resource to me? Or did you think, I'd like to work in magazines. I'd like to be on that side of the fence. What was your sort of experience?
Very good question. I mean, I always found them very useful in what I did. So for MTV, mainly as a research thing, I also DJed on XFM for 7 years. And anything I was doing, if I was interviewing someone, you know, across the board, I would always, you know, again, it was that thing of, I want to read them and I enjoyed reading them, but then it was very useful in my work. Did I ever really want to work in magazines? Funny, I was actually offered once, I think it was to be editor of Ministry of Sound, and I just didn't even acknowledge it. I just carried on doing what I was doing. I think I was having more fun going out filming all this stuff for MTV. But
That's a good reason.
It's true. I did want to make a magazine. I mean, this is not an original idea. The week I've done it, there was a magazine called Cover. I did want to do, and I still want to do at some stage, maybe, a magazine that really is the best of the magazines. But in my take of it, in that, you know, curating, because obviously that's a buzzword that everyone's using at the moment, but light the week, but cooler. So, because for me, this is something, again, that I really find in a magazine. You can give me the most crazy, almost boring-looking magazine, but I see the positive in all. You know, New Scientist, we were just saying this before, maybe 7 out of 10 issues I get don't really interest me. Suddenly a cover will come along. It'll be like Dark Matter of the Brain or something. You think, I want to read it. So for me, I'd love to do a magazine where you take a bit out of Wired, take a bit from New Scientist. Maybe the Observer Fashion has just done an incredible piece. You know, the food magazine, Serial, some, you know, showing all so many. A retro piece from whatever, Playboy, the Cameron Crowe interview from 76th Bowie. Just that whole curation stuff.
That's really interesting because I know you've talked before about, well, we've already alluded to this thing of the internet and how that's changed the field. Mm. And so magazines then as this resource, and before it was literally the place you had to go to
exactly.
get your information. Do you think that, do you still treat it that way as a, I think, an analog internet? Is that still how you consider them to be? And the role then of curating, either in filleting the best for a new title or just bringing the real important information to the connoisseur, is that still something that you think they do,
I do.
Better than the digital sources?
I think they can. Obviously, the ones who are digital, who replicate a lot of the physical, are doing it anyway digitally, like New Yorker and all these, you know, Vanity Fairs. But yes, I think, because again, it goes back to the value and the core. I mean, it was very interesting. I, you know, met with the guy, Ronajoy Dam from Vice magazine yesterday, and he, you know, they've got the most fantastic brand. They're doing TV, they're doing all this stuff. But he said, our core, we never want that magazine to go. We started with the magazine. We will keep that magazine. And, you know, ironically, I was reading it back on the way after the meeting, front cover here with these two insane twins in the new Harmony Korine film. And it grabbed me. Would I have got that feeling from the internet? Probably not. I probably wouldn't have found it on the internet. So, yeah, I do think, you know, they are still got that power.
Well, we're going to carry on rifling through your stacks of magazines right after this.
If you're looking for great Monocle content on your smartphone or tablet device, download the Monocle app today. We'll bring you the daily Monocolumn Bulletin with fresh opinions from our editors, the essential 25/25 city guide to the best business cities and resorts, and the full Monocle 24 radio experience with our time shift player, so you can catch up on any shows you may have missed. Download our Monocle app today for your smartphone or tablet. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to The Stack. Let's go back to our magazine reviewers and their selections. Rosa, I wanted to ask you a little bit about Serial once again. We talked about sort of minimalism and that approach. You know, the newsstand is still a very competitive marketplace, and we talked a bit about first impressions, be it by touch or sight. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a risk implicit in being a little more gentle in your presentation, or is that something that you're very comfortable with, letting things kind of speak for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you're looking at more established titles where you have big headlines and different straps telling you what's inside the magazine, and you look at Serial, it's literally just an image and our very small logo. And I think perhaps if we were stocked at, say, W.H. Smith, a lot of people wouldn't even notice that we're there, buried under piles of different magazines. But where we are stocked are usually galleries and independent bookshops and concept stores where people can fully see the entire magazine just kind of in a neat little stack. And I think because of the way that we are presented, we don't necessarily have run into the problem of, oh, will somebody notice us? So it's where we're stocked, really.
That's interesting. So it's kind of appealing to the eye, to some extent, of the kind of the magazine connoisseur, if you like. And I know some other things you're doing. You've got a stationery set, this kind of thing that you're launching. Do you think that's the future for certainly some of the newer kind of media brands, to have those kinds of tie-ins, to create a whole lifestyle? I mean, it's obviously something that, you know, Monocle's very careful about, the kind of partnerships that we engage mm-hmm. with. A lot of our commercial partners are sort of small firms, a lot of emphasis on quality and old-fashioned craftsmanship. That's definitely the way ahead, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak on behalf of other independent titles, but for Serial, from the onset, I knew that I wanted it to be more than a magazine. The magazine would always be at the core of what we do, but I knew that I wanted to do stationery and product collaborations and not rushing into anything, but just kind of taking our time. And stationery was a natural extension of what we do, kind of that love of paper and beautiful stock and tactile. So yeah, it's been lovely. We launched a series of custom notebooks because I wanted to see what the reaction was like. And that's kind of a trial period. And then we'll have a full capsule collection coming out around autumn.
I think you should do a restaurant.
Yeah. We will see about that.
James, in terms of looking back through your sort of extensive archive, and I know you've obviously filleted some of the best for us, did you get a sense as you were looking through, maybe even today, to pick out a few titles? Was there something you thought, wow, this was a golden age? I mean, we were in the 80s there, you mentioned late 70s. Did you find yourself thinking...
You're reading my mind.
Hankering back and thinking, oh, you know, really, 76 to 79 was the perfect time.
Oh, I love it.
Was there a particular one that really stands out for you?
I think it's like, I think you can get very personal. So obviously magazines that resonated to you at those times will do it. And I mean, yeah, but really a couple here. Wired. When Wired launched in, where was it? I think it was very early 90s. Can't remember the exact day. I think 92. That's, again, spoke to me, as they say, because, you know, you'd had 60s punk acid house. And I think this movement was amazing. You've got the desktop publishing, you've got the internet and technology. I mean, look, it's amazing on this. This is the one we've got here from April 94 with Bill Gates on the cover, and how they're referring to the internet here, the info barn. But that revolution is still with us, you know, 20 years on, whatever, we are still. But yeah, Wired. Wired really excited me because it was that whole new movement that was coming through. So yeah, I loved it. I got excited by digging this one out.
So that's one of the sort of golden ages. I think we can admit there were a few.
Zines, by the way. Zines that kind of came off that. Here's a little one quickly here. Fact Sheet 5, which again, you didn't have the internet was so basic. It was so, email was so embryonic at this time in the early 90s. So this was basically fantastic by a guy called R. Seth Friedman. And it just listed, like, intensely all the zines out there, underground magazines for those uninitiated, you know, comics, sex, stuff, politics, literature, health, queer, art, girls, fringe, movies, all the subcategories. I mean, that blew my mind because it was like, wow, here's more stuff I can devour.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I've got a zine here. We were talking about this one before we came on air. Motorcycle fanzine, back down to Australia. This one really appealed to me, particularly because it's got a little pocket at the back with a, you know, nice stitch on patch, so when I'm riding my hog, you know, I can have that on my denim cutoffs.
Don't you love it? Don't you admire those people for going to that effort?
Well, it's fantastic. And just you look at the artwork, it's such a style. There's incredible sort of, you know, inserts and, you know, amazing artwork, and it's got such a look of its own. I'll let you have a look at that. It's called Head Full of Snakes.
You shut me up now.
What do you make of that, James, at first sight? Does that sort of appeal to the inner sort of magazine, the hoarder?
I don't like hoarders so much because to me, hoarder sounds like there's no intention and reason behind it. Collector, but I'm not that offended. But it does.
Oh,
I'm
dear.
A little okay. Got a little bit of hoarding in me, but I love it. This is genius.
It's a really good one. I mean, it's interesting. Then we've seen zines through the ages. You mentioned these bigger, wider trends. Rose, do you think that there's any sense that the magazine market broadly, it's in robust health, certainly around the fringes? Do you think it's lost its way at all? Are there things that concern you in terms of, like, prevailing trends internationally? Or do you still feel that there's enough scope for people who have great ideas and good products to still be successful?
I think there's still enough scope for people to be successful in their own way with different ideas. I think the thing is that things are always evolving, and the magazine industry is constantly evolving. And, you know, I mean, what's right at that time, if you have an idea. I think everything is actually about timing. So success is often, you can have a great idea, but you might have it at the wrong time. You can have a great idea and not execute it. And I think, yeah, you can always succeed if you have a great idea at the right time.
But Thomas, what you say, like with Monocle, it's the brand extension. It's like you almost shouldn't just treat it maybe as just the magazine, you know, extend it. Like with the music business, we've now got to realize with a CD, you can't just have the album. You've got to go on tour. You've got to do something. Do the T-shirts, do the other things that complement the magazine.
That's really interesting. And it sort of leads me to think about how we look at magazines more broadly. You know, we talk about them almost as artworks. And in so many cases, they really are. And I guess, James, this speaks to obviously what you're doing at the moment with your collection.
By the way, can I just say, if you want artwork, Nice magazine was just a block of wood. That was it. Three different covers that had different ads on the back.
That's art. Definitely art.
There we go.
Well, do you think then it's an overlooked art form? Is it time then for more museums, galleries? Oh. Is what you're doing perhaps leading us towards that?
I'm going to collapse with excitement. That's my dream and an excitement. Absolutely, a museum to appreciate it. I mean, to the best of my knowledge, in the world, there is no magazine museum. And the content, what's in there is just, you know, I just recently did a thing, helped the V&A supply all the magazines for the Bowie. And you go there and it's amazing. You know, pop culture and magazine content is such a zeitgeist. It's so needed to be appreciated and preserved.
So tell me a little bit then about the plans for the archive. Is it going to be that? Is it going to be a museum, or is it going to be more like a carefully managed resource that people can tap into? What's the sort of the big vision?
There's a lot of avenues under discussion at the moment with a few people, but one of the most immediate is this museum, because I think, again, from that museum, so much can be done there. You can have talks there, you can have events there, you can host. I mean, again, the ideas are limitless on how many, you know, exhibitions you could come from that content. So that is the most immediate thing, is to get the museum underway, and it's under discussion. There's some fantastic supporters, and I hope it happens.
Another reason to be optimistic. I'm liking the generally upbeat tone today. Let's turn Rosa back to you and see what are some of the other ones that you've brought in.
I'm gonna pick National Geographic. I brought this in because I thought it was apt. They're in their 125th year. And I mean, I know everybody, for the most part, knows what National Geographic is. And it's just, I love how iconic it is. And I feel like when you're looking at National Geographic, you feel like you're exploring with them. And they go to parts of the world that I can only dream of going to. And it's just, yeah, it's so classic. And I love that they've been around since 1899. And every time I learn it, I was just telling James that sometimes you have to power through some features. It's really heavy, but you've got to finish it because you're learning, and it's quite geeky, and I love that.
It's amazing. And it really speaks volumes, doesn't it? That classic, you know, the yellow frame, the signature style. It was a shorthand for knowledge acquisition. I know we keep coming back to this, but it was like pre-internet. That represented a path to something that wasn't out there for other people. Was National Geographic, was that on your list?
In the collection, got them going back to the 20s. I will confess, it is low priority in reading, but I admire its beauty.
We're hearing more from Rosa and James right after this.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental, it does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's A Review, every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Now, we've obviously got plenty more magazines to look at. But, James, I was just wondering, before we delve back in, it's interesting, and it must be particularly interesting as a collector, archivist, if you will. You can trace, I guess, big things, trends, big movements in the business. We've had the death of print has been announced time and time again. To put you on the spot slightly, where do you think we're going next? What's sort of around the corner? Are there any big prevailing trends that you think
in magazines
we should be looking out for in magazines? Yeah,
because there's so many and I read so many, I couldn't answer that. That's a fantastic. I can't. I mean, I just think they all survive. You know, a few fold, a few come and go. But you know, a lot of them I look at. Look at this magazine here, which is, you know, The Wire music magazine. I mean, that's been going for, I don't know, 30, maybe nearly 40 years. I've probably got that wrong. But it's niche. You know, these things have got their amazing little niches and they all survive. So I couldn't tell you where the trends are going to be because I'm blown away when I go into Wardour News and like a kid, it's like that famous Mad magazine cartoon. There's a little kid and he's only got like 5 cents. He goes into a fireworks shop and the grumpy shop owner gives him the most rubbish firecracker and then he just lights it and throws it in the shop and sits back and watches the whole shop. Great fire. You know, that's how I feel like in Wardour News. So I do not feel no pessimism in magazines when I, you know, like being on the show excites me and going in those shops and seeing on the internet just how many magazines are coming out. I you know, couldn't be healthier.
This is very upbeat. Rosa, you feel the same way? Where's Serial going to be going next? What are the plans then for the next sort of few months or even further ahead if we dare look that far?
I mean, I think for us, we just launched Volume 2 last week. So it's very early days. And I have an outline of how the issues are looking for 3 and 4. And I think at the moment, we're just kind of still working on creating our brand identity and doing it really well. I mean, we're very much leaning towards travel a little bit more so than food at the moment. And I think I see ourselves kind of going down that path. And I'm also interested in perhaps bringing in a little bit of lifestyle into the magazine content. I think because, as I said, it's such an extension of the things that I love and interest me. I don't want to lack focus, but at the same time, you get all this great content that you want to cover and you just kind of have to evolve and meet your needs and demands.
But where does that evolution go, do you think? If the magazine continues to do so well, continues to attract such good reviews, let's say one of the, you know, these big prowling giants sort of comes along one day and says, hey, we love what you're doing. Maybe we'd like a piece of that action. Is that something you've entertained or just too early, do you think, to think about that?
I have thought about it because it's just one of those things that you kind of do think about when you have a magazine. To be perfectly honest, I have no idea what I would say if that moment came. It's really hard to say. But I mean, I think for me, I envision Serial kind of continuing always as a print magazine for as long as it's possible. But to that end, we're also rebuilding our website because I want the website to be a place where people can log on to and have all this other information that complements the magazine, but it's different from it. And as I said, I want to build different brands surrounding Serial. So I think these days a lot of new magazines, because you're offering a lifestyle to your readers, you then kind of corroborate that with all these different offerings.
I mean, James, that's really interesting, isn't it? That idea of how you can complement, you know, the great quality output that you have with your print product with other avenues that are there online and through other digital medium. Do you think that how you engage with magazines has changed at all since the internet has become so all-pervasive? I guess it probably makes it easier in terms of tracking down, you know, issues perhaps that you
exactly.
wanted to define.
But you're right, it has.
Has that changed the experience, though, do you think?
Yes and no. You can still be excited, but I mean, again, I don't know why this one's come into my head. When I was sorting through the archive, I came across all these old comics, and this fascinated me. I can't remember the comic. Maybe it was a Wizard and Chips or a Monster Fun. I'm showing a bit of my age, but I'm not a retro guy. I mean, I will digest and devour and keep going. I want the new stuff. But this was an interesting thing going back to you about how, again, this pre-internet showing you the time and the speed and that, you know, obviously the physical and digital do marry each other and come at each other. What happened in this comic? There was a thing inside the comic saying, hey, you can win if you can have basically a bath of R-Rite's lemonade poured in the bath by a famous footballer. You know, you win. It was a bizarre thing. You couldn't do that kind of thing now. It took about 8 months for that competition winner to be announced, because you imagine there was no internet. These people were writing in. They were doing the thing. It took time to process. The magazine was slow. It was a slower paced world. And then 8 months later, whatever, the front cover of the magazine's got this comic strip of some little kid getting, I don't know, Kevin Keegan pouring lemonade into his bath. Don't know how I got onto that. What I'm saying is, yeah, now there is more of that immediacy. They will be tweeting about the new issue. There will be this coming out. I mean, in Time Out this week, there was a thing of the London Zoo, and they're launching this new tigers there. And it was, run your phone over this and you're going to get the, Erasmus. In hidden contact with the lion, tiger growling, or, you know, win a trip. You know what I mean? They are doing more of that. And you didn't have that in those R. White's Lemonade days. You were more passive. You could only write in.
Now, it's interesting. Rose was talking about, sort of owning a magazine and how you see it, you know, growing up through the world. It's almost like a little sort of piece of you that you're looking. Now, your experience, I guess, is slightly different. But of course, you still have this proprietal sense of all of these magazines that you own. And I just wondered, do you have favourites?
very hard to have a favorite. I'm sorry, I can't.
But I'm gonna.
It's like you. Come on. Would you have a favorite meal, a favorite drink, a favorite sort of a song?
Possibly. If I was on the spot, but let me put you on the spot further. So let's say we've got this archive of material.
Yeah.
Let's say a dreadful event was occurring.
Oh don't utter those words.
The classic. Yeah. The classic burning building, James. That's where we're going with it.
What would I say?
You have to dash in. You've got 5 seconds. Where do you go? I fail to believe there can't be one thing you think, oh, I've got to get that out.
You see, I could be really weird and say the thing that's nearest to me in the moment of panic. I couldn't, because it's not the Playboys.
That's a good answer.
You know,
that's
it's not the Playboys necessarily. They're beautiful. It's not necessarily the face. Could be a few iconic covers that meant something to me.
No favourites.
I've got 50 favourites.
Good. I'll accept that. That's a good answer. Now, Rosa, just tell me very briefly, you know, Serial, exciting times, issue 2. You mentioned your plans ahead for the next couple. Anything that you're already thinking, oh, we've really got to do this?
Oh my goodness, there's actually so much. I have a map on the wall where I'm marking places that I want to go, which sounds a bit cheesy, but it's really what I do. And at the moment, I'll just tell you a couple of places that's really tweaking my interest. It's Serbia, Belgrade. I really want to get myself to Montenegro at some point this summer. I'm actually going to Krakow tomorrow, which is exciting because I've never been there. So I think the things that really excite me tend to always be travel. I'm like dreaming of these destinations that I want to go to. And I find myself moving away from bigger cities and towards more. There is no such thing as off the beaten path now, I think. You know, everybody's been everywhere, but more so that, you know, that track.
And can I just quickly go back on
that? Sure, sure.
It could nearly be Jocks, because so much of me, maybe of me growing up, was in that magazine. You know, you hit me there. Would I save, maybe save the Jocks?
That's it. This is. I feel like
too
deep.
That's therapy.
I feel like
you've helped
me. I feel like this is a bombshell. Let's just wrap up by maybe looking at one or two last titles. It could be the last one though. So let's make it count.
Pretty much my last one to sum up my, as I say, my resonance of the moment is long form pieces. So The New Yorker is read every week. Vanity Fair is read every month. I loved Word, which sadly folded because that did some nice deep pop culture articles. But, you know, just some couple of things here. You know, Vanity Fair, they did a great article on the making of Pulp Fiction. New Yorker. What I love about something like New Yorker, they can do a long form piece that just, again, entrances you. They did a thing in 2011, Crunch, Building a Better Apple, or What Procrastination Tells Us About Ourselves. You know, deep articles. So for me, I'm bowing out here with, you know, long form represented by a mag like The New Yorker.
I think that's a pretty solid place, to wrap. Rosa, have you got a final one you'd like to mention? An honorary mention, perhaps, to any of any of the others you brought along?
Okay, I'm going to pick Smith's Journal. I found Smith on volume 3, which is the version that I brought, and I just thought it was such a fantastic magazine. It's actually meant to be a men's magazine, but I mean, I read it and I love it, and it's very story oriented, people oriented, and they find the most incredibly fascinating people to interview, and I'm so jealous that they get to meet these people. I mean, here's this man that I've never heard of before, but I really should have, and he has designed every product that, you know, you come face to face with on a daily basis, like parking meters, food processors and typewriters and Kodak cameras. And you don't really think about that. And then you have a magazine like Smith that says, hey, check out this guy that created all of this stuff. And I love that element of Smith. I find that all of their features are very like that, the unexpected and the expected.
Fantastic stuff. It's about the people. It's about the stories. That's what we love so much about magazines. What a great way to end this edition of The Stack. My guests today have been James Hyman and Rosa Park. Our producer was Adrian Craddock, and our studio manager was Ben Jay. If you have any comments or queries, drop us a note at info@monocle.com. Remember, we'll be back next Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. And of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or via iTunes. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening. Thank you.